Hey everyone, welcome back to Brand New Techish. I'm back again. This is Michael Behane and I'm joined with the amazing
Abadesi.
New Techish, we back in the building.
Back in the building.
Back in the building. Where should we start? What do you want to start with?
Let's talk about that $1 billion we raised.
The $1 billion that we raised. Yeah, so basically, guys, now we are now billionaires. And actually, if you want to listen to this podcast, you've got to pay us because we've got so much money. Ain't nobody got time for that. No, I'm joking. So, you know what? I want to start with a story. So Notion, the app that we love and that we're always talking about, they have recently raised an angel round of $10 million.
Angel round.
Quotations. $10 million. Yeah, angel round. Stereotypically, how much is an angel round normally? A couple hundred K?
Six figs max. Yeah.
But they have been around for a while and they've just are wildly popular and they've raised and this is the crucial part, the valuation was 800 million.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's so almost a unicorn. Almost that's a unicorn. Baby unicorn. That's a teenager unicorn.
It's like a young unicorn adult. To beat. Apparently, they actually chose 800 million because they were like, they didn't want the hassle of a unicorn status.
999 million.
Essentially, yeah. They're like, we don't want the kerfuffle. And they have been beating away VCs. So I'll get a quote. Yeah. Back in February, one of the team members said, we decided not to list the company's office address on Google Maps so that prospective VCs would stop showing up uninvited anymore. There's been so much interest in the company. Now, if you're a founder listening to this and you're struggling to raise money, how badly does that hurt that there are companies hiding their address so that VCs can't just roll up in your yard and be like, yo, can I invest?
Actually, life goals.
Should we explain what Notion is? Explain it.
Okay, so I like to describe Notion as Google Docs on steroids because it's a collaborative workspace where you can do whatever you want. Think of any kind of document. Maybe you need a Kanban board to track leads. Maybe you need to like do some word processing. Maybe you need to have some kind of visuals. It's the most beautiful UI ever. You're effectively navigating through your own personalized website, but you can do whatever you want. It comes with preset templates. Lots of people use it for tracking their workflow, their to-do list, lots of different projects. People run their companies off of this.
Yeah.
And it's just incredibly intuitive, beautifully designed, and has an incredible amount of integrations. You can embed articles as bookmarks. That's what we do here at Techish.
Yeah.
You can embed any type of audio. So you can include a link from a SoundCloud clip and just play SoundCloud from within Notion. It's just incredible.
It's
and
the
if you're
bomb,
still
basically.
On Google Drive, man, y'all be tripping.
Yeah, you'd be messing up. Like it's, I literally run my whole company off it. I literally run my whole life on it. Like I've got one for my life and it's got stuff like, you know, my girlfriend's birthday, like, and wow. I've got like a Trello board in there. I call it Trello. It's meant to be a Kanban. I've got a Kanban board. Yeah, same thing, whatever. And then I've got like one for like, I'm learning a language. I have all my favorite phrases and stuff like that. Everything,
wow.
man. You can run your whole life on this. So
you're a premium subscriber.
I am, yeah, for some of it. Yeah,
wow.
I had to, man.
How
they upsold
it?
Me. It's not a lot. It's like £10 a month, something like that. Yeah, it's not bad.
Okay.
Listen,
I can
not
pay
be cheap.
That.
Support software, man.
I can pay that.
But like, they have absolutely killed it. And I think their mission is to kind of take out Microsoft Office. And you know what,
damn.
Though? I can kind of see it, to be honest.
Wow.
Not Office, because Office is like used by...
Can't mess with Excel, though.
Yeah, you can't mess with Excel. They have spreadsheets as well, though. Yeah, they do.
I haven't used that yet. I haven't got that far.
But it's amazing, though. I think I'm not too familiar with their backstory. From what I recollect, though, this wasn't either their first product or it was a slow burn. It took a long time for them to blow up. Like, and they've been around for a couple of years and they just built slowly and kept building the background and eventually just blew up. I don't remember how it got on my radar. I think I saw a tweet about it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, what is this product? And then it just snowboard. And like, I think me and you have probably told every single one on our podcast to download it.
I tweet about it.
Yeah, and we tweet about it. So like, that's how you grow through word of mouth. Shout out to Notion, man.
Yeah, I know one of the founders I follow, Ben Lang. He seems to work at both Notion and InVision. But yeah, interesting.
The team's only got 25 people, so it wouldn't surprise me if they've got a couple part-time Donnies, bro. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. So here's a tweet from Jason Calacanis. Yeah, he's a famous angel investor. He invested in Uber. He's probably got hundreds of millions of dollars. So he's talking about the calculation of whether investing 10 million for 800 million valuation is a good idea. So he says, is it a good bet or a bad bet? They've got around 1 million users, and let's assume that 10% of them are paid, which is $96 a year, which basically equates to $10 million in revenue. So this valuation is 80 times their top line revenue.
Wow.
So, I don't know. He thinks it's a good bet. I mean, in a traditional Warren Buffett style of investing, that's a terrible bet. But like in a tech game, 80 times revenue is pretty decent. Anyways, watch the space, man. I think they're gonna be the next company to blow. This episode is sponsored by Customer.io. Send automated messages, deliver results. With Customer.io, you can send targeted emails, push notifications, and SMS to create lower churn and create stronger relationships and drive subscriptions. They're also hiring on pocketjobs.com, so go check them out. Boom. Speaking of valuations, so and kind of like founder type stuff. So Adam Newman, I think that's how you say his surname. He's the co-founder of WeWork. Yeah, so WeWork is valued in the multiple billions, and they're going to do they're potentially going to do an IPO. But it turns out that he, as a founder, has already cashed out at least $700 million already
through stock. My eyebrows are raised.
So what does that mean? That means that essentially, before the company, when you go public, that's when that's meant to be your quote-unquote liquidity event. That's when you, as the founder, are meant to get rich. You sell your stock to the public markets. But essentially, before they've even gone public, he's already cashed out 700 mil.
Aren't you locked out of doing that? I'd be curious to hear what time frame in which he did that. Because there's like lots of restrictions around that kind of
Because they have this thing that called secondary markets.
Right.
Which is basically where before your company gets sold, you can sell your shares to other investors who want to come in. So let's say you start a company, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Then I come in and I'm like, Abba, I know you... You don't necessarily want to sell your company to another company right now or go public. But as a later investor, can I buy your shares from you so I can get involved and ride the train with you to the top? So him as a founder, he's done that now and he's made over 700 milli, which I don't know, man. I don't know how I feel about that, because I feel like when
feels weird, man.
Yeah, why do you feel like it feels weird?
Because I feel like it's a sign of your confidence in the company and the impending IPO, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, the point of a capital event is to maximize the value of the company to deliver returns for the shareholders.
Yeah.
So if you are confident in the IPO like process and you're confident you're going to get listed at a good price, because, you know, you need to shop around to all the different banks and financial institutions and be like, yeah, okay, we're going to go in at, I don't know, $15 a share, $20 a share, whatever. If you're confident in that process, then you're going to want to hold out on everything that you've got, hold on to everything that you've got so that you can, you know, basically benefit from the IPO. Of course, you're going to probably be locked out of like liquidating any of that for some time. But still, if you believe in the value of that stock and you believe it's going to keep increasing, then there's very little incentive for you to change, right? I mean, this article from the Wall Street Journal, which talks about it, that we were reading from, our source, also talked about how, like, before the Groupon IPO, the CEO at the time, Eric Lefkovsky, he sold more than, like, $300 million in Groupon stock. Now, Groupon stock famously tanked after the IPO. I think it debuted at $16, and within a few months was, like, trading at $5.
Right. And you worked there, right? So you know more than anybody.
I was watching my stocks just dwindling. I was like, I'm gonna buy a house. And I was like, well, I'll be lucky if I could buy a pair of jeans.
And you're wearing them right now.
My threadbare jeans. Groupon jeans. I'm a millennial. but yeah, I don't know. I feel like that to me feels like a lack of confidence. What do you think?
Absolutely. You want the, if I'm going to invest in your company in the public markets, I want to know that you've got skin in the game, that you believe in this stock as well. Yeah. And the fact that you are selling your stock, it makes me feel like it's rats leaving a sinking ship.
Like a game of poker, right?
I don't play poker.
I mean, me neither, but I've seen it on TV shows. And it's like you're either all in or you fold.
Right.
But, you know, if you really believe in the cards in your hand, then you're like, no, I'm all in.
And what does it say if you're an employee, that if you know that, for example, that the CEO has already cashed out shares that you can't cash out, that you can't cash, you're stuck with this company's equity, because you're waiting for the IPO as an employee, but the CEO has already hedged, essentially you're hedging your bets. You're saying, if this company goes tits up,
WeWork look after their staff, though.
I'm sure they do.
They spoil their staff. They took everyone to like Universal Studios this year. Like everyone in the whole company. Basically, he knows that they have been burning cash like it's going out of fashion.
Yeah.
And that's unsustainable. And the minute they go public, that's not going to last. So he's just like, let me diversify.
Exactly. Yeah, he's hedging his bets. And it's like, do I want to invest in a company where the CEO doesn't even really believe in the value of the stock? Because if you think about it, if he thought that he was sitting on an Amazon,
of course not.
He wouldn't do this you'd be like, in 20 years time, like Amazon is, our stock, our company is going to be worth 100 billion.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to sell now. Yeah. But the fact that you're cashing out basically says to me, at such a high level, says to me, okay, cool. I don't believe in the value of the stock. It's a quick flip. I need to get out of it.
The market share that WeWork has right now, in my opinion, will decrease dramatically over the next few years as they run out of cash. WeWork is burning through money. Most people I know who are at WeWork are there for free because they're just trying to fill up desks. Meanwhile, they've paid out huge...
Bring me in, bro. I need the hookup, fam.
It's too cold for you, man.
No, I'll go there,
There's a dress code. There's a dress code.
I'll go there in my hoodie. What about WeWork people?
But I just think it's such an unsustainable business model, and he knows that, and he's just like, yeah, well, it is what it is, done.
Yeah. Because they're wildly unprofitable, basically.
Also, was their rebrand successful?
What was their rebrand? Into like,
they
the
rebranded
Wii company?
As the Wii company, and you could live in a co-working space, or like, you know, live in a Wii thing. You know what? Let's not be too critical of WeWork, because ultimately they put remote work on the map.
Co-working space type thing, right?
Co-working in a remote work flexible environment thing. They put it on a map in a way that no other brand or community has succeeded to do. I mean, here in the UK, we've got companies like Regis, for example, which are like, they were doing exactly what we were doing, but they were just so dry.
Right.
So kudos to them for that. But the cost that they paid for doing it has meant that they have created a very inflated cash balloon of a company.
Right.
And that will all come tumbling down.
And they've raised money like they're doing some high tech AI, machine learning, and it's not. You're an office company. And
what's the proprietary technology?
There's absolutely nothing.
Of WeWork.
Like, we're actually working in a co-working space right now, and if you turn this into a WeWork, it wouldn't make a blindest bit of difference to me. I couldn't give a damn, you know what I mean? But anyways, yeah, watch the space. I mean, my prediction last week was I feared for Netflix, and your prediction is that you fear for WeWork.
Well, interestingly, yeah, so I do fear for WeWork, but what actually has been interesting is that I heard from one of my friends that... their father's property in Nigeria that he owns has they've been approached by WeWork.
Okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're trying to do a little Wakanda thing there.
So I was like, oh yeah, you forget that WeWork is going out into other markets,
right?
South America, Central America.
That doesn't fill me with hope. When I see an unprofitable company trying to grow into new markets, I'm just like, God, this
spreading
is gonna
yourselves too thin.
Yeah, this is gonna blow up. Anyways, we'll see. I mentioned Netflix briefly. So speaking of Netflix, you know, last week I was like, I fear for them. But they've actually done something amazing. They've managed to rope Eddie Murphy out of his stand-up retirement. And he's going to do a stand-up show.
Raw 2019.
Raw and delirious. And he's getting paid $70 million. $70 million. Now,
you better pay his child support to Scary Spice.
If you're a bit young, yeah, you're listening to this podcast, you're going to be like, well, Eddie Murphy, the guy from Dr. Dolittle or Night Professor, that's the Eddie Murphy that of the 90s and the noughties.
Coming to America.
But yeah, but Eddie Murphy from the 80s, he was funny as hell. You know what I'm saying? And his stand-up game, he was the most popular stand-up comedian of all time at one point. I think nothing has beaten Raw and Delirious.
No.
So I'm actually excited. Now, $70 million, though, do you think he's worth that? $70 million! Bearing in mind, Dave Chappelle got something similar, and Monique got offered 500,000, which is absolutely laughable.
What?
She got offered 500,000.
Monique from friggin' Brandy Show. Oscar
winner. No, not... Is it? Was she in the Brandy Show?
I feel like she played the mom in the Brandy
Show. Maybe you're right. Yeah. So she's from Prussia. She's an Oscar-winning actress.
Yeah.
What was
that Brandy sitcom called?
I've forgotten.
I need to find it now.
Fact check. Was she in it? Okay.
Brandy and Ray J, A Family Business. No, that's not it.
Incorrect. Our survey says...
We'll find it.
Anyways, yeah, so Monique got offered 500,000.
Oh yeah, Brandy. Moesha
was the show. Was she in Moesha?
She definitely was.
So the name of the show was Moesha, but you don't know if she was in it.
She was the mom!
She was. Okay, cool. I'll take your word for it.
She was the mama.
So, yeah, like, so some people have actually said, like, okay, this is an example of, like, you know, misogyny, racism. I knew it, fam.
What was she then?
You just throwing up random shows, bro. I had to fact check that. So anyways, it's just a whisper quietly in the background. No, she wasn't. I heard it. Anyways, so what do you think? Is that an example of
the thing about Eddie Murphy
discrimination?
Is like, of course, it's an example of just
500,000.
Okay, obviously, Monique maybe isn't as much of a cult icon, but like, we can never pretend that structural oppression just goes away sometimes. I'm not going to suddenly start forgetting that we live in a world where men's work is valued more highly than women. But the thing about Eddie Murphy is, was he as good in his later years as he was in his early years?
I thought you were going to say, is he any good in Raw and Delirious?
I'm
you
just
mean
saying
now?
That,
you
like,
mean,
oh, yeah, the Dr. Doolittle franchise, that dragged out.
Yep.
I feel like he had a few other films I didn't even watch.
He's flopped so many times.
Because it was just, you know, and then there was a whole custody or paternity thing with Scary Spice.
Yeah.
I don't know, Eddie. I feel like I've seen the dark side of Eddie. Now he's all
tainted.
What
was the story with Mel B? What was the story?
He denied paternity, so he denied childcare. And I just kind of think, that girl's going to go on the internet. She's probably already on the internet. I reckon she's like in her early teens now and see that stuff. And I just think that's so... It's not good.
Yeah, that's nuts. I think, what is it about? Like,
and by the way, he was the father.
He was the father.
So after all of that, they finally did a test.
They got Maury involved. No, you know what? The thing is, it's... What is it about, quote unquote, I use the phrase quote unquote by like great men, because even Steve Jobs did that as well. Like, he denied the paternity of his child. And it's like, you're both 100 millions up. Like,
it's
what
like,
are
were
you
wearing
doing?
A condom? Yes or
yeah,
no? Okay,
exactly.
Who's the daddy?
Like, yeah, I'm just like, wow, anyways. But, you know, his personal life aside and his character aside in that sense, as a comedian, I'm going to watch it. I have to, because I grew up on his stand-up shows, but I just don't know if 70 million is really... This is why I fear for Netflix. Like, do they really recoup 70 million when they give...
Yeah, of course.
You think so? In what? New subscribers?
They've got so much money.
I don't know.
Yeah, advertisers. Also, think of how much product placement are in the shows that we watch. brands are paying to be in this Netflix stand-up show.
He's not exactly going to be like, oh, look at my Rolex. Like, he's,
subtle ways. Okay, how about this? I just did a little interesting research here. If I asked you the market cap of Netflix,
right,
how much do you think the company Netflix is worth right now, based on the shares that are out there, based on how people are valuing it?
Is it like 20 to 30 billion?
Higher.
100 billion.
$141.88 billion.
Yeah, they got that cash money. Let's put the Nigerian accent on it, didn't you? They got that cash money.
Of course it is.
Let's watch the space in it. Like, let's see what Eddie does when he comes out. Oh my days, yeah. So speaking of like just terrible behavior from human beings, so there's this dude called Marcus Hyde. He's like an Instagram photographer. Not an Instagram photographer. He's a photographer with a very large Instagram account. And he's taking photos for like Kanye West, Kim Kardashian. And he's been known to take a lot of, basically, he takes pictures of high profile people and they're really meant to be kind of artistic. And normally, sometimes people are like scantily clad. He was caught recently offering models free pictures if they'd sent him nudes.
For God's sake.
There was a DM where somebody was like, okay, like,
oh, good Lord.
Somebody was like, okay, like, how much for pictures? And he's like, $2,000. And they're like, okay, but if you do me nudes, it's free. She's like, so what, for nudes, it's free? He's like, yeah. So now his account's been suspended. And I think Kim's had to come out and be like, yeah, you know what, I disavow this person, I can't believe you did that, rare. And it's just like, bruv, like, what's going on with my gender? Like, what's happening here? Like,
that's the oldest trick in this industry? In the book, man.
Yeah,
like,
man.
I mean, sad to admit it, but I know people who've been like, who answered, you know, back in the old days, classified ads or whatever, like, oh, come get free modeling photos, blah-de-da. Like, that guy, Terry Richardson. And like,
who's that?
He was a guy that used to do photograph campaigns for American Apparel and stuff, and he basically got charged with sexual harassment because he was like, yeah, okay, now take your panties off. Yeah, great, now do this, now do that. And people were just like, wait, sorry, what? This wasn't in the brief. So it's again this idea of like, one, objectifying women, which we have normalized. I've just been listening to Emily Chang's book, Brotopia, about this very topic, and, you know, we are awash with images of women which are hypersexualized in comparison to men. I'm not saying that men are not either, but I'm just saying disproportionately so.
Explain. I got it.
And so, there might be some men out there being like, it happens to me too.
Jordan Peterson told me this. Jordan Peterson said, actually.
But yeah, I just think, you know, maybe Instagram's even making it worse. I don't know.
So?
I just don't know. Like, on the one hand, there are people out there on Instagram having incredibly positive messages, which I love. But at the same time, you know, one, we're always going to have abuse of power wherever it exists. Yeah. That is innately human. We just love to take advantage of people. And then two, there's always going to be creeps.
Yeah, I think especially with the entertainment industry, if you look at like Weinstein and stuff, whenever you have the ability to be a gatekeeper as a man, a lot of scummy, creepy people are going to use that as a way to kind of
power
trip, get sexual favors, all kinds of creepy stuff. So yeah, that's
just push it.
Yeah.
I think that as humanity, you just see how far you can push it. It starts small. It goes further and further and further. I don't know. Our brains are a bit twisted, honestly.
Yeah.
They're bringing back Blade. That was a good film.
Man like Mahershala Ali. Yeah. So, you know, apparently, quick backstory. So Mahershala Ali is going to be in the new Blade. It's going to be in the MCU, which Abba knows nothing about. I'm just going to throw that out there because she has not
Marvel
seen the Avengers.
Comics,
she has not seen anything.
I know Black Panther.
You know Black Panther. There we go. That's what that matters. That's the most important one.
There you go.
But so
Mahershala
Ali.
Spider-Man in that?
Yeah, Spider-Man. There we go.
I know some of them.
You know Iron Man, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So Mahershala Ali, he came out at Comic-Con and he was like, yo, I'm Blade. And everyone was just going mad. Supposedly, actually, he approached the studio and was like, yo, I want to be Blade. And they were like, yeah, we're doing it. They didn't even have plans to make Blade. He's an Oscar winner.
Yo, I want to be Blade. Does it work like that?
It don't work that way. Okay. You got to be an Oscar winner, innit? So I'm gassed for that, man. Obviously, you know, maybe Wesley was a bit too old now. But yeah, I don't know. What's the talking point we could say on that?
Why don't they have like Blade, new Blade versus old Blade coming together?
Wesley, but, you know,
like,
but you know Mahershala Ali, he's like 45 though. He ain't even that
what?
Young. Black don't crack, baby.
Black don't crack.
As in, I would have figured him 37, 38.
Wow,
yeah, so
45.
Yeah. I don't think he's even, I mean, maybe Wesley's like 60, so it'll be old Blade versus less older Blade.
So well.
I don't know. It's the melanin's magic, innit, boy? So yeah, basically the dude who invented the retweet, he's come out now and been like, yo, basically like was given like a nuclear weapon to like children and that we didn't realize what we were doing when we built it. It was absolutely amazing. He says especially the quote retweet is like demonic. He calls it the dunking, where you can just be like, take someone's tweet and then just dunk on them and be like, well, actually,
yeah.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. So It's just amazing how you can build tools and not really realize the ramifications of those tools, and all you're caring about is maximizing engagement and maximizing, you know, efficiency within a product and usage within a product, and you're not realizing the wider implication. You're just a designer or a developer or a product manager, and little do you realize that, you know, you've probably ruined thousands of people's lives with quote retweets, and, like, you know, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that analogy is fair, that it's been that damaging, the retweet button and the quote retweet? Because essentially, back in the day, if you wanted a retweet, you'd have to copy and paste someone's message.
Yeah.
And then put RT and say that's how you did a retweet. This is really back in the day, old school Twitter. Like, there wasn't a button where you could just retweet. You had to manually copy and paste it and then tweet it yourself and put RT next to it. So it was almost a way that if you were going to retweet something, you'd have to really, there was enough friction for you to stop and think about it. But actually, do I really want to retweet this?
Yeah.
So now they made it so frictionless that moment of pause to stop and think about whether you actually want to do something is no longer there. And that's so symptomatic of tech. Everything has to be frictionless. Everything has to be just like immediate and easy access, but without thinking about, because it's great for engagement, but you don't think about the ramifications socially. And I think you're going to see more and more of this. Like, you're going to see more and more people that have had a larger role to play within these companies saying,
regretting it.
I regret it.
Yeah, but what are you doing about it? Like, what's regret going to fix? Like,
regret ain't going to do nada.
This is what I'm saying. Like, oh, oops, I messed up. Do something about it. Like, you've got a platform, you've got a position, you're in a senior product role at one of the largest tech companies in the world. Don't just say it. Do something with it. You know what I mean? Like, put some of the money that you've made into counseling young people that are suffering from mental health issues because of this stuff. Put some of the money you've made into fighting trolls and better anti-harassment features for Twitter. I don't know, like, it's all good and well to massage your conscience with this, like, you know, thoughts of regret. But if you're not functioning within the capitalist system and actually driving a change, I don't care. I don't want to hear you. You know what I mean? So I get a bit frustrated when I hear tech people trying to earn, you know, brownie points or, like, gain some, you know, karmic good points by saying, you know, that they regret what they've done. Well, no, just change it then. Like, do something about it.
I agree. So there was a story we meant to talk about last week, but we didn't mention it. It was basically about how there was a study by Sifted.eu, which is a new publication out in the UK, and they looked at what's the educational background and the career experience of UK venture capitalists.
Uh-oh.
And they found that only 8% of them have actually worked in startups. 8%. The equivalent number in the States is about 60-something%. Now, if you're listening in the States, I know the situation over there is bad, and you're going to be like, we've got problems. But fam, do you know how bad it is when virtually every single VC is just an MBA who went to Oxford, who went to Cambridge, who probably would be working in finance if they weren't bored and decided to give the VC game a go? Like, how can you invest in people if you don't even know what they're going through? How can you relate? How do you even know anything about startups if you've never even worked in one? That's it's such BS. And the reason why it vexes me, because it's so symptomatic of this country in the sense that everything is about what school did you go to and what connections you have. A lot of it is. We've just had a prime minister come into power, Boris Johnson, who just went to Eton. Yeah, which is, it's just the establishment controls so much it, and it's so much about your connections and whether you went to the right boarding school and whether you've got the right degree. Like, and it's not enough about, it's not, we're so far from a meritocracy. It's not even, it's so crazy. I don't know. I did a little rant there, but what do you think, man? As in, does it surprise you? Did you find that figure surprising?
I'm not surprised because I've met lots of VCs. I mean, there aren't really that many. It's a very small industry.
Yeah, out
really.
Here. Yeah.
But, you know, in proportion to other types of finance or whatever, like, there aren't actually that many individuals, and most funds, like, have very lean teams. I'm not that surprised that, again, based on the anecdotal nature and also the fact that, you know, tech, if you think of, like, the culture of the startup scene and how that sort of, like, grew with the roots in the kind of, like, 60s almost kind of Cold War kind of era where, like, science and innovation kind of, like, mixed and, like, all this kind of stuff. I don't know, like, there's an interesting book by Fred Stewart called, like, Counterculture. I actually got it recommended by Patrick Collinson from Stripe because he always talks about his reading list. Truthfully, I haven't finished reading it, but anyway. it is interesting to just see how much of the fabric of the American identity, like, Silicon Valley is, and that startup culture and tech, and then how many generations of founders with successful exits have continued to invest in that ecosystem, and we just have not really had that here.
It's exits, that's the problem.
And it's also, you know, America is, I'm speaking in, like, broad strokes of the paintbrush here, but it is a very risk-taking and risk-loving culture.
Right.
It's very new compared to the UK. It has different values. It prioritizes things in different ways. Even like status is very different here. Status is very grounded to your background. In America, it's more grounded to your achievements. So it's disappointing to hear. And like, do you know what? Maybe that's why we don't have that many exits.
Maybe.
We just don't have that process knowledge. We don't have that capital. We just don't have that process knowledge. We don't have that experience. Saying
we don't have even that, the cultural
know-how
to even to have that. And it's, yeah, and it's very hard to get the ball rolling initially. Do you see what I'm saying? Once the ball is rolling, just like anything in life, whether it's fitness, whether it's, you know, your love life, your health, your social life, it's so easy once the spiral has started. And when the spiral hasn't started, it's so hard to get it moving. So the fact that we have no exits here means that it's harder for us to have entrepreneurs with the knowledge to help us get exits. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And then there are less big companies to acquire the other companies. It's really bad. And even, to be honest, the question of diversity within, you know, the whole ecosystem is also factored into the lack of exits. And the fact that there are so few black and brown founders that have had exits also means there are less likely, it's less likely that black and brown founders are going to get funded, because those founders don't have the capital to go reinvest in, you know, their cousin or, you know what I mean, their friend of a friend, right? And it's just like, it's such a self-perpetuating cycle of, you know, limitation. That's the only way I can phrase it.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody keep upbeat, you know, let's not get, I'm getting a bit downhearted right now, but like, there is a way out of it, but it's just, it's not going to be easy.
And also maybe we have a bit of a brain drain. Like maybe here, really good in founders in the UK go to America because there's more money and more opportunity and people are more open-minded.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you're
We'll see how that changes now with Brexit. Probably going to get even more of a brain drain, honestly.
So we've just had Boris Johnson elected as the Prime Minister of the UK. And he's a very unpopular figure. He's been called the Trump's UK.
Well, you say he's unpopular, but he just got elected by a majority. So he's just unpopular with our circles.
No. Actually, he was elected by his party, and that represented about 0.1% of the whole population. So we'll see how he fares in like a proper general election. So essentially in the UK, your party wins, and then your party wins an election, and then if your party leader steps down, that party selects who the next leader is. There's not like, in the US, it's more of a presidential system where the president is selected by the people. Anyways, I digress. The point I wanted to make is that he has two or three, or at least four or five people of colour in his cabinet. Now, a lot of people are like, some people are like, oh my God, like, it's amazing, you know, in a super right-wing government, we have four or five people of colour. And some of us are like, yo, like, of course, not all skin folk are kinfolk, and diversity alone isn't enough if you're just going to perpetuate terrible policies. And this is, like, the textbook example, like, you know, like, me and you are very passionate about inclusion and representation, but what does it stand for once you get there? What do you stand for once you get there? Like,
yeah, I mean, I can be a woman and still think that women are inferior to men.
Completely. And did Margaret Thatcher being Prime Minister have any impact on women in a positive sense?
Hard to say.
Hard to say, right? On a policy level, at the very least.
I mean, she was, like, optically, was the first role model, right? Female Prime Minister.
What do you think?
I think it is important for people to measure... I think it's important for people to measure the impact of individuals' work, not only by their profile or what they look like, but by the results they deliver and what they do.
Right.
And I think with someone like Priti Patel,
who's a cabinet member,
one of the cabinet members, she's a woman, Indian woman, Indian British woman. She's now Home Secretary, so Secretary of State.
Mm.
The Conservative government, in all the time that they have been in power, have been very anti-immigration and haven't done the best job.
Mm.
Of fighting anti-Islamic sentiment in the country, anti-immigration sentiment in the country, just because someone from a black minority ethnic background is in that position doesn't mean that these policies are now going to change to be pro-inclusion, pro-representation, pro-immigration. So you're right. For the people that, honestly, people who say, wow, this is awesome, look who's in cabinet, they're the people that probably don't understand the extent and the complexity of the issue. Because or they're not affected by it. Because, you know, it's like, oh, great, look, there's someone there now. You can all shut up.
Yeah.
I don't want to go too deep into politics because I feel like I could be here all day. But one thing I wanted to mention was this viral Medium post that came out earlier in the month called Survival of the Richest.
Mm.
And it's written by Professor Douglas Rushkoff.
Shout out to him.
And he was invited to speak to a room full of tech investors and hedge fund managers.
Mm.
He was asked to speak about the future of technology.
Right.
And what he realized was they weren't that interested in the future of technology. Rather, what they were interested in was how they could continue to protect their assets after what they called the event.
Wow.
I.e.
I'm scared.
You know, when climate change reaches the point where it all goes feral and primitive. Yeah. And so what he found so fascinating was that this is the future of technology to them. How do I survive? You know, from Elon Musk colonizing Mars to Peter Thiel reversing the aging process, people like Ray Kurzweil trying to download their brains into hardware. All they want to do is survive. And he said what was sad about that was that you've got the most powerful people in the capitalist system, as in the richest people in the world, mm-hmm. who feel that they have no control over the future despite having all this money. And he said the ironic thing about that was that their whole perspective was that they would have to isolate and protect themselves somehow. Right. And what he argued with was it's the exact opposite. Don't pull yourself away from humans and the society and the world around you. Rather, connect more deeply with the people around you so that when the event happens, you don't have enemies, but rather you're working together as a united force. Because if humans are to survive, it's not about I'm going to step on as many people as I can so I can get to the top of the pile of bodies. Rather, it's how do we work together to fight a problem that is bigger than ourselves. And I just wondered, like,
they must have laughed him out of the room when he said that, boy.
Yeah, I didn't believe him, obviously. But I just thought it was, like, really interesting because, I mean, these are the people that are ultimately shaping our future. And the thing at the top of their mind is, how do I...
Escape. That's so depressing. So depressing, but kind of vaguely predictable at the same time. Yo, everyone. That was this episode of Techish. I forgot to do an outro last week, but we got one this week. yeah, leave a review, retweet, share...
And did you know you can go on patreon.com/techish and support the work we do.
Yeah, man.
If you like us, pay us.
We really appreciate it. Catch you next week. Ciao.
Bye.